Honestly, I don't know. I mean, sure, markets go down too, but that being normal kind of assumes other things are normal too, you know? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, the 21st day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, so maybe that was a tad despairing, that bit up in the open a minute ago. But the general vibe isn't wrong. There are a whole lot of things that came together this week, and the economy operates, as you know, not in a vacuum. So here we go with the week that was. Neela Richardson is at Edward Jones. Dion Rabone is the markets editor at Axios. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kat. Hi, Kai.
What's going on?
Not a look. So, Neela, I'm going to start with you, and I want to just touch briefly on the Fed meeting this week. We did some coverage of it. I do want to know what you think of this statement, that the Fed was trying to be gentle in its statement and saying, look, we're rethinking things maybe. But then clearly in Chair Powell's press conference, everybody heard them saying, oh, yeah, no, we still might raise rates. What do you think?
He was definitely trying to thread this needle, one between an economy that's growing but at a slower pace, and to acknowledge all these market worries and market anxiety dealing with geopolitics and trade tensions and the fact that the Fed may raise rates. I think at the end of the day, what the rate hike showed is the Fed still thinks that the economic expansion will continue and it's strong enough to withstand a couple more interest rates next year. Markets didn't like that and they responded resoundingly. It doesn't change the economic fundamentals that are driving the Fed's decision, though.
So, Dion, the Fed chair gave a speech like, what, a month ago at the Economic Club in New York, and we had you on to talk about it that day. And you talked about this thing called the Powell put, which is basically you think Powell was saying to the markets, I got your back, man. We're going to be all right. Take it easy. Do you think that Powell put is still in effect?
Well, that was how the markets took it. And I think Powell, for his sake, is really he didn't necessarily mean that. I think there's a back and forth going on right now between what investors think Powell means, because he's new to the Fed. He speaks very differently than former chair Janet Yellen and former chair Ben Bernanke.
He does, totally.
And
that's true.
Particularly, Alan Greenspan, who didn't speak a whole lot.
Yeah.
So, you know, the market's still trying to figure out what this guy means and whether or not he's got their back. On November 28th, they came out thinking, yes, this guy's got our back. The Powell put is in place. If things get bad, he's going to lower interest rates and, you know, get the market back going. And I think what happened this week was they said, wait, hold on a second. I don't know if this guy actually does have our back. And, and they've reacted accordingly.
Interesting. So, Neela, a related but different topic. The Fed talked about global economic growth and how it's keeping an eye on that. Fred Smith, the CEO of FedEx, came out this week and pointed to a bunch of things, Brexit and the tariffs and China and all of that, and said, you know what? This is all kind of self-inflicted. We could turn this around in a heartbeat if we wanted to. The catch, of course, being that nobody seems to want to turn it around and do the non-disruptive things.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that statement, look.
Take all the time you need.
Sure is.
Europe has its own concerns. Brexit was not a U.S.-led policy, so that has to be resolved. Italian deficits definitely did not come from the U.S. And the China slowdown, yes, that has some U.S. implications and maybe some U.S. drivers in there. But, you know, China is not slowing down just because of global trade. There's some domestic issues as well. What's affecting FedEx, though, is the here and now, and the fact that slowing global demand means less demand for what they do, which is deliver stuff. And that's what they're concerned about.
Dion, give me a gut check, right? Does this feel, you know, all the turbulence and the, this is the only possible word for it, chaos in Washington about the shutdown and politics and the president and all this, and then the global stuff, does it feel real and substantive, or does it feel transitory?
Oh, it's very real. I mean, the thing is, though, as Neela pointed out, this could be walked back. It would just require for these men, Donald Trump, Theresa May, I guess a woman in there, but Xi Jinping, to not be who they are, to kind of step back and really pull this thing back and for things to go in the opposite direction of the way they've been trending. This trend of populism, of anti-democratic norms, of folks not working together, people just kind of saying it's my way or the highway. That's been growing for the past few years. Brexit was kind of the first domino to drop in that, but it's just continued and things have really moved in that direction. I think that's what the FedEx CEO was pointing to. And it's funny, when you look at FedEx, they're experiencing, I think, something similar to what we're seeing in oil. You see this oil price drop and drop and drop, and people keep talking about, oh, there's more supply in the U.S. Really, that's a demand issue because people aren't doing as much business. They're not going out as much. They don't need as much oil, as much gas. And that's really what I think is at the heart of that. And so I think FedEx is feeling that. A lot of businesses are feeling that. And I don't see any reason why it would stop, considering this is a trend that's just built and built and built and built. It's not going to turn around on a dime. It's going to take a big, big thing to get things to start moving back in the opposite direction.
Neela, play that out a little bit, pointing to some of the surveys that have come out in the last 10 days or so with CEOs saying, oh, yeah, we're thinking of a recession end of next year. Economists are moving up their forecasts for a recession. What do you make of that?
Kai, there's no easier way to be wrong than to call a recession too early. And the longer we are in this expansion, the more people are going to come out and say there is going to be a recession soon. And you know what? Eventually, they will be right.
Yeah.
Yes, the business cycle goes up and goes down. And eventually, you wait long enough, you'll get a recession. But the question is, here and now, we don't see it. We see a growing economy, 4.2%, then 3.5% the second and third quarters. We see consumer spending strong, and we see the lowest unemployment in 50 years. So right now, the corporate America is left to their own devices, which means growing their revenues and growing profits, even as interest rates also increase.
Neela Richardson at Edward Jones and Dion Rabowan, brand new markets editor at Axios. He's got a new gig. Thanks, you two.
Hey, thanks, you, Kai. Have
All
a
right.
great week.
See you. You too. On Wall Street today, look, do you really want me to? Because I will if you make me. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. True story. I was working for the federal government during both of the Clinton-Gingrich government shutdowns in late 1995, 5 days right before Thanksgiving, and then 3 weeks, I think, around Christmas and New Year's. And both times, we all had to go into the office, sign forms acknowledging that we weren't going to come to work or do any work from home for the duration, and that, oh yeah, there was a chance that when it was all said and done, we weren't going to get paid. We did get paid eventually, but that kind of wasn't the point, you know? So with, at least as things stand now, because honestly, who knows, but with a shutdown in the offing, I went out on Twitter this morning and asked federal employees and contractors who might get hit by this thing to share your stories. Marketplace's Ben Bradford has the roundup.
Sure. People who get paychecks from the federal government would feel this shutdown, but imagine this.
We will have to call brides and cancel their weddings.
Margaret is a park ranger who says some winter weddings could have to wait. Almost 400,000 federal employees also could be put on unplanned, unpaid, possibly unwanted vacation. But workers who were scheduled to have the week off would have to show up. Chris Barrett is a correctional officer at Loretto Prison in Pennsylvania. Over a year ago, he put in a leave request so he could take his wife and three sons hunting next week. But as an essential employee,
we'll be expected to show up for work. All of our annual leave that we have scheduled, that gets canceled.
He also wouldn't get paid for it until the government reopens.
Could be a day, it could be a week, it could be 3 months.
The most recent government shutdowns have lasted just a few days. But in 1995, a budget impasse closed most federal offices for nearly a month. Barrett makes about $60,000 a year for his five-person family, and he says it could get tight.
You still got your mortgage payment, car payments, cell phone bills, telephone bills. You know, those people still want their money. They don't care.
Essential employees like Barrett will get back pay eventually. But for those like Alex Case, a government attorney who may be told to stay home, back pay is a question mark.
That takes an act of Congress, and that doesn't feel like a sure thing these days. We have savings, and we'll pull from that, but I'd like to keep that money right there.
In past shutdowns, that's been resolved, but federal contractors don't get paid for their time off. Richard Cardenas's small construction business in Texas has a federal contract.
It's just one of those things where you're waking up every day, opening the news, and trying to see if you can get back to work.
A shutdown is looming, but no one dreams of a tight Christmas. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
We do a semi-regular series on this program, the basic thesis of which is that economic headlines about record low unemployment and a growing economy are all well and good, but if people aren't feeling that in their own economic everyday, then those headlines don't really matter, right? But there is a flip side to that theory, and it goes like this. Economic headlines about a turbulent stock market and tangible signs of slowing are troubling, but if people are feeling all right in their economic everyday, then what's the worry? Exhibit A for that, the Consumer Sentiment Index from the University of Michigan, which came out this morning. It rose a bit in December and, in fact, has been holding near a 20-year high all year. From our bureau in Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
Hairdresser Rosie Balderston Denbo was meeting friends today at an outdoor market in Portland. I asked, is she worried about the stock market?
No, I'm self-employed. I work part-time and I'm still doing fine.
Denbo's lack of concern, it's pretty common, says Carl Van Horn at Rutgers University.
Most people don't pay any attention to economic forecasts. So if you ask the average person on the street, it's not part of their lived experience.
According to a recent Gallup poll, just over half of Americans have any investment in stocks. And for many of them, it's through retirement savings plans. So they're probably not following the market or economic stats day to day, says James Boniker at IHS Market.
Most people have a good job, their incomes are going up, and just feel very good about the state of the economy right now.
That's especially true for low and middle wage workers, whose earnings are up sharply, says economist God Levinon at the conference board.
There is a very significant increase in satisfaction with job security for people at the lower end.
And those are the consumers most likely to spend their paychecks right away on basic expenses and travel or gifts if there's a little extra coming in. Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research thinks there's a good chance the broad base of consumers are right about the overall health of the U.S. economy.
When you look around for things that could give us a recession, I just don't really see one on the horizon.
Though he does acknowledge troubles with trade, interest rates, debt could get worse next year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Here's another consumer story based in part on how consumers show all that confidence that Mitchell was talking about, how they buy things. When it comes to getting a credit card or taking out a loan, consumers face a bit of a paradox, right? To get credit, you need a good credit rating, but to get a good credit rating, you need a credit history. Something like 50 million Americans don't have enough of a credit history to generate a solid credit rating. So the credit rating company Experian is rolling out a new service. Customers who opt in give the company access to what's going on in their checking accounts, specifically when they pay their utility and phone bills. And then that information is rolled into their credit history and, in theory, if everything goes right, gives their credit scores a bump. The devil, as always, though, residing firmly in the details. Caveat emptor on this one. Marketplace's Renata Sago explains.
Who are those people with little to no credit history and therefore poor credit scores? Dara DeGay runs an advocacy group called the Credit Builders Alliance. She says they're jobless 20-somethings, baby boomers recovering from divorce, people who prefer to pay in cash.
It could be immigrants that are new to this country.
When they go to a lender to ask for a mortgage, car loan, or business credit line, she can predict the outcome.
They're going to, in most cases, charge you a higher interest rate than someone that has a good credit history and good credit score.
Which is why she likes Experian's new service. It allows consumers to create histories for themselves by sharing their utility and phone bill payments with Experian. And if their record's good, it can make getting credit easier and less expensive for them. Consumer credit analyst John Olsheimer says, sure, but this isn't just about the consumer. It's about Experian saying it has something to offer its customers, the lenders.
Look, we have a way for you to do business with more consumers because more consumers are going to have scores.
But there's a big catch for consumers. Amy Traub is Associate Director of Research at the Public Policy Group, Demos. She says lenders will be able to use the data they collect to make marketing decisions.
Who to promote, which products to, how to get us hooked on the products that are most profitable and lucrative for the lender.
This is the second new service that credit agencies have launched this year that allows consumers to share their checking account info. In October, Fair Isaac Corporation, home of the FICO score, launched a service called Ultra FICO. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Anxious, frustrated, angry.
And that's how your accountant feels about tax day next year. But first, let's do the numbers. So look, I don't know what to tell you. The Wawa's. It's the Wawa's all the way down. Dow Industrial's off 414 points today, 1.8%, 22,445. The NASDAQ off 195 points, nearly 3%, 6,332. The S&P 500 fell 50 points, 2%, 24.16. For the week that was, gruesome is not too strong a word. The Dow down 6.8%. The NASDAQ off 8.3%. The S&P 500 down 7%. Campbell Soup named a new president and CEO. The executive comes from Pinnacle. Mondelez International will take over in late January. Campbell's cooled off 5% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.78%. You're listening to Marketplace. We do more than the numbers here at Marketplace, you know. We tell the stories behind the numbers, stories of real people, of businesses, both big and small, and of the impact the economy has on each of us. Because you appreciate this kind of public service journalism, we're asking you to give something back. Please donate today at Marketplace.org, and your gift will go twice as far thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Dion and Neil and I were talking earlier about the Fed and its meeting this week and the what with the economy and still rising interest rates. Fed Chair Jay Powell said during his press conference on Wednesday that he and his colleagues on the Federal Open Market Committee are rethinking how many times they might raise rates next year because, said the chairman, and this is a quote, we know that the economy may not be as kind to our forecasts next year as it was this year, end of quote. Neil Kashkari is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, not a voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee this year. But last year when he was, he voted against all three increases in the federal funds rate, the main rate that the Fed does control. Neil, it's good to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you are, as you and I talked about last time I was out there in Minneapolis, you are a dove. You're not either worried about inflation in this economy. The Fed, however, the Federal Open Market Committee, keeps on raising interest rates. Why do you suppose they're doing that?
I think we're all trying to balance different risks. The risk that I'm focused on is that there's more slack in the economy. There are more workers who want to work. So let's let that continue to strengthen. Some of my colleagues are worried that if the economy overheats, inflation might pick up and then we'd have to raise rates really quickly. And then that could slam the brakes on the economy. And I think that we just look at the risks a little bit differently.
The statement that came out on Wednesday afternoon was, in the vernacular, it was pretty dovish, right? You guys changed the language a little bit. You made it seem like maybe you're going to think about not raising rates as many times as you had been thinking. And yet Chairman Powell came out and his question and answer session read a bit more hawkish, that perhaps are going to be more rate increases. And Wall Street then took that and said, oh, my God, the world is ending. Do you think Wall Street misread what y'all were trying to say?
Well, it's hard to know, you know, what's embedded in Wall Street's expectations and do we meet their expectations or not. We don't want to be too sensitive to Wall Street, but we also shouldn't ignore it. There is information there, and we do pay attention to it.
Your colleague, John Williams, the president of the New York Fed, a voting member on the Federal Open Market Committee, went on, I guess it was CNBC this morning, and said, you know what, we're going to be listening to the data. We're going to be keeping an eye on things. And it sort of sounded like he was trying to get a rally, not trying to get a rally going, but that Wall Street would read that as something worth buying on. How much appetite do you think there is amongst voting members of the FOMC, which you are not, we should say, for taking a pause and having a look at the data?
Well, I think we would all agree that we're not on a preset course, that we do want to pay attention to the data, both the financial market data, but especially the real economy, what's happening on Main Street, and that should be guiding policy. So I think we're all committed to that. It's not a crystal ball. It's not a perfect science. So we have to balance the various risks. And I think we are all trying to balance the risks. And we're all in agreement. We want the expansion to continue as long as possible. I'm in the camp that not raising interest rates would help that to happen. And some of my colleagues are in a different place, but I think we all agree on the goal.
You know, when I was out there in October, I guess it was, I asked you, in essence, what the Fed was afraid of in terms of inflation. And you said to me, look, I think they're still scarred by the Volcker era runaway inflation of the late 70s and early 80s. Do you think that's still the case? Because I mean, you guys writ large, you, the Fed writ large, spend a lot of time thinking and worrying about inflation. And I wonder maybe if you're overdoing it.
Well, I think that that's a real concern. I mean, I think historically when central banks have screwed up around the world, it's because they let inflation build, and then that really was damaging to the economy, and they had to raise rates dramatically to get it back in check. I'm sympathetic with that broader concern, but we're just not seeing any signs in the data that that is actually a risk that we're about to face.
Since you mentioned it, I'm going to ask you about it. You said back there a second ago, we're worried about screwing it up or something like that. What happens if you do screw it up? What happens if the Fed screws it up? Because inflation, as you know, can come on super fast.
Well, if inflation comes on super fast and we have to raise rates really quickly to keep it in check, that could really slam the brakes on the economy, and that could put the economy into recession. So that's one risk. Another risk is if we raise rates too soon and the economy doesn't need the higher interest rates, we could put the economy into recession ourselves. I wish it was an exact science. It's not entirely clear, but I'm in the camp of let's be patient, let's let the economy continue to strengthen, and then let's raise rates when we know we need to. I don't want to end the expansion prematurely if there's no inflation actually building.
Neil Kashkari is the president of the Minneapolis Fed. Neil, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me, Kai.
Tomorrow is a year on the nose since President Trump signed the GOP's Tax Cuts and Jobs Act into law, the biggest change to the Internal Revenue Code in 30 years, as we told you repeatedly at the time. The calendar being what it is, though, most of the changes in the thing didn't go into effect until January the 1st of this year, which means we are just now heading into the first real tax filing season for tens of millions of us. So, miserable as that might be for those of us actually paying the taxes, spare a thought here for the accountants and the tax lawyers who are still scrambling to understand a good many parts of that law, thanks, in part, to the IRS. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports on what it means to be an accountant in this age of uncertainty.
You know those commercials where somebody's training for a marathon or the Olympics? They drag themselves out of bed at the crack of dawn, lace up their sneakers, and begin the long slog. Inspiring. That's basically what I witnessed on Tuesday, except the people in training were accountants. Instead of sneakers, they had cups of coffee, 6-pound tax manuals, and for inspiration, Sharon Kreider.
All right, we have to know the formula, what's qualified business income. There are three separate limitations on the deduction.
Kreider is a CPA from California, and she's standing in front of a packed hotel conference room in Manhattan. More than 100 accountants have paid about $1,300 to take a 5-day course on accounting practices and the new tax law. Kreider's been teaching these seminars in cities all over the country. She says the mood in the room is pretty much always
anxious, frustrated, angry.
Because the new tax law is more than 1,000 pages long, and it's still not clear what a lot of it means.
And we end up with people with tax preparers who should know more by now, not understanding.
Not understanding things like whether your clients in the real estate business qualify for a sweet new 20% tax deduction. Matthew Rappaport is a tax lawyer in New York. He says he spent
probably somewhere between 500 and 1,000 hours
trying to make sense of the new law. Rappaport says Congress passed it quickly and
gave the IRS a set of statutes that were not very well drafted and said, hey, why don't you go figure it out?
Let's just say the IRS isn't there yet. So Rappaport doesn't know if his real estate clients are going to get that 20% tax break. The IRS says to qualify, you need to run a, quote, trade or business.
Well, what does that mean? In the regulations, they said it refers to Section 162. Well, Section 162 has never clearly defined whether certain real estate is a trade or business or it isn't.
Welcome to the accounting version of hell. Caesar Boca Chica is a tax preparer in Virginia. He says last tax season was so grueling, he rarely got to tuck his daughter, Daniela, into bed or read her a bedtime story.
By the time I got home late at night, everyone was sleeping, and all I had to do was just eat and then go to sleep, wake up, and do it all over again.
This year, he'll have the added pleasure of deciphering the new tax law and double-checking the work of the real number cruncher in the room, his computer.
We have to make sure that the tax accounting softwares are able to correctly calculate all the different changes that are happening.
Keep in mind, limbo is not a comfortable position for accountants who are being paid to stand between their clients and an audit by the IRS. Carla Blanchard is a CPA in Illinois. She's also been going to training seminars on the tax law because, you know, safety in numbers.
Just in case something comes up, you know, especially with a new tax law, nobody really knows what's going on yet. At least you're being consistent with what your peers are doing, and you can kind of fight the IRS that way.
By then, the IRS may not have all that much fight left. It's been undergoing budget and staff cuts for years. And Sharon Kreider, the CPA from that five-day training session, says IRS agents are exhausted from cranking out regulations as fast as they can.
You might have heard me say that I'll bet there are a lot of IRS employees with a bottle of gin in one hand and whiskey in the other as they crawl out from under their desk.
We ran that by the IRS, and they told us their agents are working hard. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which is, depending on how you look at it, either this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us or some small measure of sanity finally being restored. From TechCrunch, this item, the Kardashian and Jenner sisters, perhaps you've heard of them? They say they're going to stop updating their apps in the new year. For those of you who weren't subscribed, $2.99 a month got you a peek behind the Kardashian and Jenner scenes, millions of dollars worth of $2.99 a month. I'm going to straight up steal the kicker from TechCrunch here. If only there was another way to follow their lives. All right, that's it. We got to go. Dow off 1.8% today. The NASDAQ down nearly 3%. S&P 500 fell nearly 2%. For the week, horrible 6-8% across the board. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizal. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.